From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 11th day of May, 2026. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's at agmarket.net. We'll hear from Andrew Margonaut today, too, crop scientist at the University of Illinois. He's been doing a great deal of research on phosphorus and stream banks. You'll want to listen to that one. And as we close out our time together, we'll get a quick update of the weather forecast. Mark Russo's out of the office for the afternoon. But I'll let you know what's going to happen for the week across the Corn Belt as we make our way through this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world online on demand at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
July corn for the day settled at $4.75 and a quarter, four higher. December at $4.97 and three quarters, up four and a quarter. July beans at $12.13, a nickel higher. November at $11.94 and three quarters, up five and a quarter, and went to a high of $12.01 and a quarter for the day. By the way, December at $4.98.5, so it did not pierce $5 today. Wheat futures in the July soft red up 15, $6.34. The hard red July up 10.5 at $6.86 in the quarter. Kurt Kimmel is here from agmarket.net to discuss a very busy week for agriculture. It starts tomorrow, Kurt, with the USDA WASDE report, which will include the first set of numbers for the new crop, and then continues on Wednesday evening into Thursday morning. So by the time we have the Closing Market Report Thursday afternoon, we should know something about the President Xi and Trump meeting. And on that same day, Brazil will release its, I believe, eighth look at the size of the crop there. So lots going on. What's the most important thing, do you suppose?
Well, probably this report tomorrow, our first new crop estimate. The average trade guess is basically dialed in here just a little over 2 billion bushels. And plus two, the bean demand might be a little slow. We'll see what comes out of this Asian U.S.-Chinese meeting here at the end of the week, going into the weekend. But I think the subject's going to be more about Iran more than anything, but we'll see how it unfolds. There's some media news, social media news, trying to kind of put together an itinerary of who's participating in this event. So we'll see who all moves to that meeting. But tomorrow is crop report. This afternoon, though, we have the crop progress report. Expect about 60% of the corn crop being in the ground, about 50% of the soybeans in the ground. It looks like the fairly dry forecast slowly starting to warm up. As you drive around the countryside, you start to see start to roll the crop in some areas. So it's time of the year we're starting to see the crop pick up some momentum in through here. Main things get it up, then we'll trade the weather forecast later on. Also, too, this afternoon, we'll have some crop conditions, particularly in the western wheat belt, see what type of ratings materialize out of that. Maybe a slight improvement on some rain events that took place. The eastern wheat belt's expected to continue to show strong soft red winter wheat potential here. But we do have that crop tour taking place this week in Kansas, the wheat quality tour. So we've got some ideas. We'll have some ideas on the boots on the ground reporting on crop size, but also too, the unknown is abandoned acres on wheat crop out west. So we'll continue to watch that. But no, it is a full packed week here. Just something about every day here to look at along with headline news. And one other thing kind of forgot to mention here this morning, we did see a 380,000 ton corn sale to Mexico. And that was divided up 220 old and 160 new. And South Korea stepped in, picked up 128 corn. So even though we are seeing some higher prices here, demand's still holding in there, Todd.
So new crop corn and soybeans flirting with $5 and $12 respectively. What might push those above that level, and how likely is that to be the case? What also might be the issues which would push it lower?
Well, to continue the upside here, we got to continue to see some good demand around the world for U.S. corn and soybeans. But the biggest factor is the commodity funds. They've got a huge net long position on all agriculture products. And so as they long continue to have an appetite to accumulate some agricultural inventory, I think that will keep the market firm in through here. But if they would happen to give up confidence in ownership in these products, then all of a sudden I think we can trend the other way. Seasonally, the grain market holds together here about this time of year. But once the crop's in the ground, it starts to roll over. They got kind of the buying and selling power in their hands. So that's the fear, if they would turn sellers on some type of world event or some type of improved weather or big production prospects. So there's a lot of moving parts, but we don't want to let $5 corn and $12 beans get away from us.
Producers should be positioned to take advantage of that during the week, or do they need to make their positions solid before anything happens?
I think at any time in through here, you can put some price floors in to keep your upside open. This headline news is, it could happen in the middle of the night and then it's too late. So I think you got to use the up days to kind of raise your floor and continue to leave your upside open for the part. Because came in here and saw a crop report and corn was limit down. So I believe that risk continues to be around. As we keep moving higher, the risk becomes to the downside. But right now, I still think we're in giddy-up mode here for a while, Todd.
All right. Thanks much, Kurt. We appreciate it.
You bet.
Kurt Kimmel is with AgMarket.net. Here's a bit of commentary from me, because I just don't quite understand why it is the Trump administration, without explanation, opted not to appoint four women to the United Soybean Board. I'd asked them, but USDA did not give the women, including the one that has already served 2 3-year terms and had been elected treasurer in December, putting her on track to be the board chair in the future, any reason for the denial. 2026 is the International Year of the Woman Farmer, as declared by the United Nations. Now, the aim is to raise awareness of the role of women in agri-food systems and the challenges they face, including land tenure, financial and technical constraints, and limited access to services and education. The UN does not mention the other things, the ugly things, the you can't do it things. USDA has long looked past the politics of most nominees to check off funded boards like the USB, because they're chosen from those elected by their peers, other farmers, to represent them. So one of two things has happened. The Trump administration has exercised a right it enjoys not to appoint someone based on their politics. I've not checked the women's political backgrounds, or it's even worse. Let's hope it's the politics thing. The farmer in me doesn't like that either, but it sure sits a lot better than the alternative excuse. Today, we'll explore the phosphorus load into the nation's waterways via stream bank erosion and how landowners can effectively set about stabilizing the banks and, consequently, the channel. We'll begin with a soil scientist leading a team of researchers and students here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
My name's Andrew Marginot. I'm a soil scientist at the U of I. I've been here since 2017, and my research team of 40-ish personnel, students and postdocs and techs, our team works on soils from the perspective of nutrients and how to make their use more efficient for crops while also reducing the losses to surface waters. We also work on topics of soil health, on carbon sequestration, heavy metal pollution, but overall, we're trying to understand how can we better manage soils to keep doing what they do well, which is to help support food production.
Do you have any ongoing research that focuses on phosphorus loss from stream bank erosion?
We sure do. That is one of our flagship projects. Currently, we are working with multiple funders. The first one to invest in this research was Illinois NREC. And now we have support from the National Corn Growers Association and the U.S. Soybean Board. So to give a bit of background here, stream banks, you know, the soil that's on the edge of the stream or the river or the creek, these stream banks, they erode. That's a natural process. That process can accelerate with human actions in some cases. But the important point is that in very flat areas like Illinois, streams try to find the lowest point in the landscape. And they do that by meandering. So think of a snake writhing back and forth. A similar approach. If you were to take a sky-high view of a landscape and you were to accelerate the time scale, fast forward things, you would see over the course of decades, the streams across the state meandering back and forth. And as they meander, they slough off the stream banks. And sediment, that is soil, enters into the water body. That sediment contains nutrients, especially a lot of phosphorus, naturally. And so stream bank erosion is a relatively overlooked and undermeasured source of non-point phosphorus loading. And arguably, it's not really an agricultural source from the perspective that it's not fertilizer phosphorus. There's ongoing research that we're also doing, which is how does the hydrology being modified by farming, things like tiling, has that led to more bank erosion? And we have some evidence that actually it decreases bank erosion. So there are still a lot of questions on the extent to which stream bank erosion is a non-ag, non-point source. The evidence suggests it is largely a non-ag, non-point source of phosphorus losses.
Is the reason that the stream banks are a larger load of phosphorus because they're deeper into the soil profile rather than just the top few inches?
That's part of it, Todd. So it might help to think about some numbers here. So if we think about a typical application of phosphorus fertilizer as, say, diammonium phosphate, DAP, that's going to be roughly 200 pounds of DAP per acre. That's what the state agronomy handbook suggests every 2 years, for example. So that's about 92 pounds of P2O5. And on an elemental phosphorus basis, because P2O5 is made up, it's just a designation, we're talking on the order of roughly, a little bit fuzzy in the math here, we divide by 2.26. I'm a soil scientist, not a mathematician for a good reason. if you let me calculate that, it's on the order of about 30-ish pounds of P per acre. So that's what's going on. And when we harvest a very high yielding corn crop, say 250 bushel, about that amount is coming off in the grain itself. So these are just some magnitudes. And if we measure soil for phosphorus content by, say, the Bray or the Mellick test, we're talking in, say, you know, 20 to 50 part per million phosphorus of what's extractable. Now, soils in Illinois, if we go all the way down the profile, they have 15 to 25,000 pounds of P per acre. So up to 25,000 pounds of P per acre. And that's because, Todd, yes, if you go all the way down the profile, along that depth-wise pathway, the total P concentration is about 800 to 350 ppm. So the magnitudes of the native phosphorus, as some call it, is orders of magnitude higher than what we're applying as fertilizer. This makes sense. We have the richest soils in the world because the parent material is loess, L-O-E-S-S. This is a fine, silty powder that was blown in after these glaciers receded. And the loess that we have in this part of the world is some of the highest fertility loss in the world. It's quite full in phosphorus, naturally roughly 300-ish part per million. So that's why we have a lot of phosphorus in these stream banks. And as you pointed out, Todd, we're eroding the entire bank. So there's a lot of material, of sediment falling in.
Why is it that farmers, landowners, the public might be concerned about this kind of sediment and nutrient loss?
Oh, there's at least four reasons that I can think of here. So the first one is that if we think about what states like Illinois have done in terms of our nutrient loss reduction plans or strategies, the first step is to understand apportionment. So where is the P coming from? Same for nitrogen, of course. And broadly speaking, we've got two divisions. We've got point sources. There's a pipe and you can measure the emissions. So a wastewater treatment plant in Chicago is a great example of a point source. Then we've got things that we can't measure. They're diffuse. They're not in one location. And we just call all those other sources non-point source. And when we think about carving up the sources of apportionment, the state plan talks about reductions in point and non-point source. The problem is because we measure non-point source by difference, not quantifying the within non-point source contributions means that we don't have the finesse to understand what is ag versus not ag. So when we measure point source, we have a good number on what is being given out for P. And we know what is exiting the state because we have gauges on the rivers that drain into the Mississippi or the Ohio. So when you subtract from the total, the point source, by difference, you get the non-point sources. And I'm saying sources, plural, because ag is certainly a contribution to phosphorus losses from fertilizer, from erosion of soil from fields. But there's other non-agricultural sources within the non-point source sector. So in Vermont, for example, they include agriculture, but also forested lands. They include wetlands. They include stream bank erosion. So if we aren't able to distinguish what is ag versus stream bank erosion, we just have it all as non-point source. And in many states like ours, we incorrectly think of non-point source as synonymous with agriculture. And that's wrong. That means that we're counting stream bank erosion as an agricultural source when it's not.
As we began our conversation, you told us that streams, creeks, rivers meander, much like a snake would on the ground, over a long period of time. Are there conservation practices, do you think, that farmers or landowners can adopt that would reduce, I suppose, this meandering? And is that something that they should do for stream bank erosion control and nutrient loss?
I'll begin with the second question, which is a really good one, is that, so if this is a natural process, should we really think much about trying to mitigate it? Let's talk about why it might make sense to just attempt that. Evidence suggests from work from our group funded by NREC and USB, NCGA, that stream bank erosion is roughly 30% of phosphorus loading. That's quite a bit, right? That's almost a third. And that's based on data from Iowa. It's based on meta-analyses where we look at every peer-reviewed scientific article ever published in the world and in the U.S. And so all of these data converge on an average of 30%. In some places, it's as low as 4% of the P's from stream banks. In some places, it's 80%. So that's an average with a wide distribution. So that's a reason for why we might want to ask the questions that you're asking. So it is a natural process, but that doesn't mean that humans can't exacerbate it. And we've just finished a study finding that in some places, if you tile drain the watershed, you can increase the flashiness of the stream, meaning that when it rains, there's a surge of water, the stream has more power, and more power of a stream, more flashiness, tends to entail more bank erosion. So there's a question of, by tiling and by trying to think about how we manage tile effluent at the watershed, might that be a way to mitigate bank erosion? And what we have found is that on a global scale, if you look at all the studies ever published, we found that tiling decreases stream flashiness and thus presumably bank erosion if you have low infiltration soils. Think of flat land with a lot of clay content. The water can't get through the soil, and so it runs off the surface. By tiling in those systems, you help absorb the rainfall, and you decrease the flashiness, and thus you presumably decrease the bank erosion. So tiling could be a way in some places to help mitigate this. Now, in some locations, we find that the opposite happens, that if soils already infiltrate well, tiling then increases subsurface drainage, and thus there's more flashiness. But on average, globally speaking, there's no effect of tiling on more extreme flashiness in higher infiltration soil watersheds. Now, I think that, of course, averages are nice, but context matters. So what could farmers or landowners do is what you asked, Todd. There's, I think, two things. One that we know works, but is very expensive, is to shield or armor stream banks. This makes sense if you have a stream bend where there is massive erosion. And shielding or armoring, there's different ways of doing it. One that's very common is to put riprap. This could be, as NRCS did back in the 60s, old car hulls, used cars on the bank. Now we use concrete or even trees, dead trees, like Christmas trees, and these buffer the power of the stream water hitting the bank. But this is quite expensive. It's really not scalable. The other approach is to think about how we manage water with, say, wetlands, where if there's a drainage ditch with a lot of stream velocity and thus power, can it go into a buffer wetland that effectively slows down the water? The name of the game here is to slow the water down. Now, that has not been studied, but I think it's a promising avenue. And the third approach is we might want to rethink about how we channelize ditches. So ditches help collect all the water from the main tiles that drain. And a lot of times they've been channelized, they've been straightened by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The problem is that if you have a straight ditch, the water picks up velocity and it sloughs off a lot of erosion. So I think that's a low-hanging fruit opportunity to try to rethink how we manage the ditches. And a lot of that is the Army Corps of Engineers jurisdiction.
Andrew Marginot is a soil scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world online on demand at WILLAG.org. Our theme music is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. Mark Russo of Everstream Analytics is out of the office today, so no update of the weather forecast from him. However, across the Corn Belt, we should see a warming trend for the week. And for instance, Nebraska, the highs will be in the 80s and 90s. Much of the rest of the Corn Belt, including North Dakota, will be from the 70s to the 80s for the week, and it'll be mostly dry. Good conditions for planting the corn and the soybean crops that are left to be put into the ground. Don't forget tomorrow that at 11 a.m. Central Time, USDA will release the World Ag Supply and Demand Estimate Report. It will include its first look officially at the supply and demand tables for new crop corn and soybeans. You can find those numbers on our website at willag.org. You have a good afternoon. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.